Consequences of Rock After Show. Conversations about the moments that forever changed rock and roll.
What made Kiss so popular? What was the scene at the time and what made them stand out?
Wow, Kiss is really unique. there wasn't and there hasn't been a band like Kiss. And I can say that honestly because I'm not a super fan. And like I wasn't in the Kiss army.
Uh-huh.
I always liked Kiss. I always had an appreciation for what they did, but I wasn't like a rabid fan. And so in somewhat of a confession, I learned a lot about the band in the process of doing this episode. I didn't know much about their start.
Yeah.
Now, I was somewhat young when they were sort of hitting their peak commercial success. So like mid-70s, you know, I was 5, 6, 7 years old. I really didn't know what Kiss was.
Right.
And that was when they were, you know, full on merchandising and lunchboxes and, you know, they were everywhere.
Kiss lunchbox.
Yeah. So I don't, it's hard to pinpoint what it is about Kiss because they borrowed elements from a lot of different musical genres. They borrowed elements from theater, from film. They had a lot of different influences. They were solid musicians, not the best, you know, not the best musicians for the time or even by their instrument, but there was something about them. And of course, you know, their identity, the makeup, their persona is something that's been, you know, mimicked for decades since. But even that, like, you know, they weren't the first to put makeup on and to play a role. You know, David Bowie and Ziggy Stardust, you know, predated them, and Alice Cooper predated them. But I don't know, like, it seems like as we talk through a lot of these episodes, it's like the band had like the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's probably what it was for Kiss, you know, like they were, they were much different than the bands in the 60s. They were not hippies. They weren't flower power and they weren't punk either. So, and they had this presence about them. And I think that's what it was. And I think the other thing that led to their popularity that came out in the research too was they played all the time.
Yeah.
Like they just played constantly. They got in front of everyone they possibly could and just gigged relentlessly. And I don't know if that translates today. I think things are a little bit different today, but you know, pre-internet, pre-MTV, like the only way you were going to get noticed is if you went out and played in front of people live, and they just were relentless about that.
Yeah. Do you see any similarities between Iron Maiden and Kiss? Because when I was listening to that Iron Maiden episode, I kind of caught a lot of the same things, right? There was the personas that they were using and kind of not necessarily the style of music, but just what they did on stage. Do you think one was influenced by the other, or do you think they're just kind of two unique bands, but in the same sort of realm of, you know, acting on stage?
Yeah, I mean, they're contemporaries, so they would have been following what the other band was doing. And I think what's similar about Iron Maiden and Kiss is that they, and to this day, to their credit, no matter what you think about Kiss and the reunion and not including Ace and Peter and all that kind of, all the controversy, but and especially with Maiden, they play every show as if it's a stadium show or as if it's like the last concert they're ever going to play. And they've always done that. You know, and some people don't like that. Some people want, you know, more of an organic feel. But it was a show. It wasn't just a performance. It wasn't just them playing their music. They were putting on a show.
Yeah.
And so you had, you know, very early on, you had these stage gimmicks that they would do. You know, they're doing it to like a club with 10 people and a bartender, you know, but I think both Maiden and Kiss from very early on, they went in with this mindset that we're going to be the best and the biggest band in the world. And we have to perform that way, even if it's only to a certain number of people. And if we keep doing that, we will eventually be playing to crowds of that size. And that doesn't happen for every band, but I think if you don't have that attitude, it never happens. So if you don't believe that at some point you're going to be playing in front of tens of thousands of people, then you don't play that way, you never make it. So all the moves, you know, the pyro, the personas, the synchronization, all of that, they were practicing, even though they weren't, you know, their friends might have been being like, dude, forget it. Like, there's no way you're going to play Madison Square Garden someday. But, like, I think for certain musicians and certain bands, like, if you don't have that belief, then you don't play that way, and then you never get there.
Yeah. You talked about Kiss's early decision to kind of focus more on entertainment rather than art. And I guess that's where you kind of see this big, like, you know, not just a concert, but a show. Do you think it was easier at that time to get popular like that? Because it's not necessarily like they gained popularity for being, you know, virtuosos. They just kind of, people were attracted to their act.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, before I answer, let me ask you something. Coming to Kiss now at this time at your age, are you shocked by anything that they did?
Musically?
At all, anything. Did anything like, were you like, oh my God, I can't believe they did that?
Well, not really.
No, I mean, right? And I think that's what's interesting is that, right, like if you look at Kiss now, if you go back and watch footage of them in the 70s or early 80s, us now, like we're like, oh, yeah, they're like a hard rock band. But you have to remember, at that time, they were shocking people. Like the makeup, the personas, I mean, Gene Simmons with the tongue and the blood, like there were people who protested their concerts. They were like, you know, they were in league with Satan. They were you know, destroying the youth's integrity. Yeah. I mean, and you go back and like the same arguments were made about, you know, Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Buddy Holly, and then it was the Beatles and the Stones, and then, you know, Alice Cooper and Kiss, and then it was Judas Priest. Like, there's always been this argument that, like, oh, the rock and roll is corrupting the youth, and like it's damaging society.
Right.
And you get that through every decade, but I think what is different is that because we've seen so much, it's harder to shock us.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 70s, what Kiss was doing was shocking. If a band started doing that now, no one would even look twice.
Yeah,
like
that
wouldn't even seem, you know. Like, you look, I think the last true shock value for me in hard rock and heavy metal was sort of like Marilyn Manson. He was shocking in the 90s.
Yeah.
But it, because there's only so far you can go before people have kind of seen everything that's going to possibly shock them.
Yeah.
You know? So I think part of, I think that's where the entertainment comes in versus art. So, you know, Kiss was not interested in being Led Zeppelin. Like, they didn't want mystical songs and epic storytelling. Like, they wanted you to come out and have a good time. I mean, look at their songs, right?
Yeah.
They're not about anything like, you know, they're party songs. And so I think you get the shock value would sort of pull people in, but then you go to the show and you're having a good time, you know? Like, and that's what a lot of parents and authority figures didn't understand at the time about Kiss or about heavy metal in general was like these kids were not going to shows and like sacrificing goats or like dancing around in robes or something, right? Like, they were going and having a good time, and Kiss is singing about, you know, driving cars and going out and partying and girls. Like, even though they had the makeup and the fire and the blood, you know, it was for Kiss, it's always been about having a good time, just having fun.
Do you think starting out not being able to like pay bills and pay for equipment and just kind of, you know, living that early life of being in a band, going from gig to gig, do you think that kind of contributed to their success? Was there a certain like resilience you think they kind of built up by doing that?
Yeah, I kind of have a theory on artists, and I know not everyone agrees with this, but I feel like you almost, in order to quote unquote make it as an artist in whatever medium you're in, whether that's writing or music or painting, whatever it is, I feel like you need a certain level of desperation. Because what I've found in my experience, in my life experience, is that if I can fall back on something, I don't tend to give up my all.
Yeah.
Because I'm always holding, like, I'm always thinking, like, well, if this doesn't work out, I'm all right, you know?
Right, right.
But I think when you put yourself out there, you make yourself completely vulnerable. And I'm not saying put yourself in harm's way, but
right.
But that might come, that might be part of it. I think there has to be a certain desperation there. And you look at bands, especially classic rock bands, you can find this story in just about all of them. In punk bands, in metal bands, in indie rock bands, mm-hmm. you have a bunch of guys or girls who come together and, like, it's like make it or break it. Like, yeah. you know, if we don't make it, like, we're going to, you know, be working minimum wage the rest of our lives. We don't have any other options. I mean, Metallica's origin story is great. Like, they would eat, you know, hand sandwiches, which was just bread. Like, yeah. you know, and yeah. they lived in old studios and factories and bands that slept on floors. And again, like, it's not the greatest lifestyle. And there are a lot of musicians who didn't make it and were lost to drugs and other things that can come along with that.
Right.
But it's the attitude. And I think you look at what happened with Kiss and, like, you know, in New York City at the time, in the neighborhood, like, they're living in rat-infested places. They're rehearsing in cockroach-filled halls. But, like, that's all they had. And, like, they were working four jobs and driving cabs and working in a sandwich shop. And I think it's that level of desperation that drives the band, because they're like, what else do I have? You know, what other option do I have? And so... Yeah. In a strange way, I think if you have options as an artist, you don't necessarily put your full self into it.
Yeah. Did Kiss have any advantage being in NYC? Like, was there anything special about it that they really couldn't have risen to fame without?
Yeah, I think there's... I'm biased because I love New York City, but for many reasons. But I think that also for many industries... Film may be excluded. I think for movies, you're talking more about LA and Hollywood, but
yeah.
New York is the center of the universe. I mean, that's where people go to make it in many different fields and industries, whether it's finance or music or art or whatever, right. politics, real estate. So yeah, I think anytime you are you can leverage the power of geography in your favor. Mm. Then it absolutely makes a difference. Now, part of that is timing.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, we talked about Seattle, right? So when Nirvana started to break, bands would move to Seattle because that's where the record label execs were going. That's where the new talent was going to be found. Yeah. So it can be temporary, but I think New York is a permanent place where people go when they really, like, they again, like, you don't go to New York and just kind of half-ass it. Like, yeah. it's expensive, it's dirty, it's crowded.
Right.
You got to really want it. And, and I think if you're a band in New York and, like, in like the CBGB's punk scene's another great example. You know, it's like, yeah, you had a scene there. You had people going. That was the origin of a sound. And even though Kiss wasn't part of that, I definitely think being in Manhattan, even though they played a lot of gigs on Long Island, but I think rehearsing in Manhattan, having access to a lot of industry people who were either there or could easily make it there, definitely worked in their favor.
Yeah. How influential were Delaney and O'Coyne? Do you think Kiss would have gotten far without them?
Well, if you had asked me that before I did the research for this episode, I probably wouldn't even have known their names. And, and again, I'm being transparent here. I'm not a hardcore Kiss fan. I knew Bill O'Coyne. I didn't know who Sean Delaney was at all until I started researching it. And the more I researched, the more I came to the conclusion that Kiss would have just been another rock band. Now, they might have still been successful. Mm. They may have been one of a number of classic rock acts that we still talk about. I'm not taking their success away from them or attributing it solely to Delaney and O'Coyne. But
right.
When you look at really the way those two men shaped the performance aspect, their mark is unmistakable. And like, I know, you know, unfortunately, Delaney died sort of disgruntled, feeling as though he didn't get a lot of credit from the band.
Yeah.
And to a degree, I agree with him. You know, I went back and I read some of the primary documents and some of the early interviews, and they clearly back then were saying how important these guys were. And then as time went on, they sort of, you know, were less complimentary. So I think those two guys helped make Kiss international superstars and rock and a rock and roll legacy, whereas they might have just been a really good classic rock band if it hadn't been for Delaney and O'Coin.
Why was the financial equality that O'Coin created so unheard of? Was it like unusual for everybody in the band and the managers to all get paid the same and split the money? And do you think it's still unusual?
Yeah, this might be another one of those things like we talked about with the shock value. And that, like, you look at that today and you're like, well, duh, everyone should get equal share, right?
Yeah, that just, yeah.
But like, that's not, that kind of equity didn't always exist, and certainly not in the industry. And I think it's dependent on genre too. Like if you look at country music today, like a lot of country performing musicians have songwriters.
Yeah.
And there's songwriter credit and royalties. And a lot of country artists don't write their own songs. But I only mention that to say that, you know, the assumption from someone who's not in the industry or not familiar with it would be, well, yeah, if there's four people in the band, everyone gets 25%.
Yeah.
But if you look back at some of the arrangements, it's not how it is. And that's led to a lot of rifts between musicians and bands over the years, as you can imagine.
Uh-huh.
So I think for O'Coin to say, listen, you're all going to get an equal share, was revolutionary at the time. And I think what it does is it, or what it did, I don't know if it would still work this way, is it creates almost a team mentality. You know, it's not like, well, that guy's going to get 50% because he writes most of the songs, and I only get 25% because I'm performing them.
Right.
Everybody's all in, and everyone knows that we're all going to get an equal share. So you're incentivized, I think, to bring your best. Whereas if you're only getting a smaller slice of it, you know, maybe you're, you know, you're doing studio sessions or you're playing in multiple bands or different projects because you're not getting what you think is your fair share. So, I think that was revolutionary for O'Coin at the time. I don't know. It's not so much now, but I think that probably really made those guys tight too.
Yeah. Why did everything fall apart so quickly though? Between Kiss and Delaney, O'Coin, Bogart?
Yeah. That's hard to say. I think there's a lot of variables that probably went into it, and not all of them have to do with the personalities. I think a lot of it had to do with the shifting landscape. As we were getting out of the 70s and into the 80s, popular rock music was changing. And it was like you had Bruce Springsteen was sort of early 80s, this sort of regular guy. The guy who works at the gas, pumps your gas at the gas station, can come up and sing. And like he wore blue jeans and workman shirts. And I think there was that sort of movement in rock, and which is completely different than Kiss's persona, makeup, stage show. So music and taste go in cycles. And I think towards the late 70s, early 80s, that sort of shock rock, Alice Cooper, Kiss, was sort of falling out of favor. And it was moving more towards like the Bruce Springsteen kind of rock. You also had sort of like New Wave, which was coming in, which was more androgynous, makeup it in a different way, very synth-heavy stuff. You had punk, which was the epitome of like stripped down, or just regular people. And then as the 80s go on, even in rock music, it gets more, it moves away from that shock value and more towards like the LA Sunset Strip hair metal scene. So all of that is very different than what Kiss was doing. And that's why Kiss took off the paint early in the early 80s, because, you know, people were kind of tired of the schlock, you know, and Kiss was not, they weren't trendy the way they were 10 years earlier. So I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, anyone's fault. I think it's just the natural evolution of the band was such that that they needed a change. And you know, you look at like another band who's good to look at over time is U2. Like U2 has had the same members since they were in middle school.
Yeah.
And the same four guys, but they have different eras of their career where they look different, they sound different, and they change with the times. And I think that's what was happening to Kiss.
Yeah. Cool. That's all for me.
Yeah. So I get to talk about the riff now, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, personally, I really haven't listened much to Kiss at all. And especially as somebody who's kind of not new to that genre, but not really into it. I think I related them closely with AC/DC.
Yeah.
Especially things like Hotter Than Hell, Destroyer, Sweet Pain, whatever. I was listening to some of those songs and albums and really just kind of got that like AC/DC vibe, especially with like the open chords over distortion and things like that. So I think that's one of the things I wanted to go for. I think we were talking about the Stones and how they kind of played with just a lot of overdrive and things like that. But I think when it started shifting, and I think, you know, you saw like Black Sabbath do this and of course Kiss, and then later like Iron Maiden, everybody starts kind of shifting from just really cranking up the volume to having these pedals or special effects.
Yes.
And so I think that the distortion is sort of that kind of trademark of that, you know, 80s rock, heavy metal, whatever type of music. So that's kind of what I went for.
Yeah, you know, I said earlier, like they weren't necessarily like the greatest musicians, but I think Ace is an exception. I think people now especially see Ace Frehley as a superb guitarist. So were there any sort of techniques of his that you heard or saw or were thinking of emulating? Because I know you kind of did a little more of an aggressive solo on this riff compared to some of the other episodes.
Yeah, I'm blanking on the exact song. I don't remember if it was, might have been Hotter Than Hell, I'm not sure. I was listening to this one song that just kind of had these open chords over, and he was really just wailing on it.
Yeah.
It sucks that I can't recall the name. But I was just like, that's kind of cool. I think it's sort of the trademark of that genre, and I guess especially Kiss, you know, they're a party band, like you said.
Right.
And so in the end, they just kind of want people to get together and have a good time. And I think using those simple chords, those open chords, are really good for getting people to do that, because they're basic, they're easy to follow along to, and you just sing along with it. But then in the case of somebody like Ace, where you have these talented musicians, they can still apply what they know over the chords to make something that, you know, they shred over or sounds really good. And so I think that's kind of cool, where you can both prove that they're good musicians, but also have the kind of simple songs for people to play along to and sing along to.
Yeah, and the thing that's also interesting about the music that we didn't really touch upon was being a party band also means you need girls to dance to it. and Kiss's music, like, a lot of it is very danceable, like the different rhythms and beats, and especially like I Was Made for Loving You is almost like a disco song.
Yeah.
So I think like that's a really, for me, that's a credit to Ace as a guitar player, that he can sort of be this virtuoso and really tear into these incredible leads, but then also kind of pull back and be able to play in the groove. Because, you know, a lot of guys who love to solo, like, they want to just go full on, tear it up.
Yeah.
And it's hard to have some kind of restraint, and it's even harder to play in a pocket. So, like, you mentioned AC/DC. Like, I was in a band one time, and we said we were going to cover, like, three AC/DC songs. So we're like, oh, they're easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started playing them, and they sounded like shit.
Yeah.
And they're like, wait a minute, this is supposed to be easy.
Yeah.
The songs are easy. But getting the AC/DC rhythm and falling into that groove and playing in that pocket is hard.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Kiss had that too. You know, Paul Stanley didn't play as much guitar as Ace, obviously, and and Gene Simmons, you know, he's a decent bass player. But Peter Criss and Ace, I think too, really kept a nice rhythm there. And I think you can, and I like in your riff, you kind of have that. You sort of have those open chords, you know, those major chords, and then sort of that really aggressive lead part.